In June 2018, in Lancaster, Los Angeles, a mother contacted emergency services to report a 10-year-old son had fallen, injured himself, and wasn't breathing. When emergency responders arrived, they were horrified at the child's condition. The subsequent investigation revealed years of systematic abuse and torture by a mother and her gang member boyfriend, and systematic failings by Child Protective Services. This is what happens when abuse behind closed doors is left unchecked. This is the murder of Anthony Avalos. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So let's go back just a few years. It's 2018, and we've got Anthony Avalos, who's living in Lancaster, Los Angeles. He's living with his mother, 28-year-old Heather Maxine Barron, and her boyfriend, 32-year-old Kareem Ernesto Laver, and also their seven siblings. So they're aged between 11 months and 12 years of age. So we can imagine it's quite a busy household. It also included in that family makeup a younger half-sister and brother. And that's because Barron had actually split from Anthony's biological father, Victor Avalos, when he was just 6 months old. Now, after moving to Mexico to find work, his father kind of becomes absent. So realistically, Victor only ever saw Anthony on video. And because we're going to be talking about a case of child abuse, obviously it's more easy to hide abuse when you are only communicating with your other parent on video. Now, it's later alleged down the line that Barron only had as many children as she did because she wanted them for the money. So she had seven children in 8 years and basically saw them as her cash cow, according to reports. Basically, she wanted to benefit from government benefits, and she obviously felt that that was a simple way to bring income into the household. But unfortunately, she isn't somebody who's exactly a connected parent. So they are definitely something that bring her a certain amount of income, but they aren't necessarily a group of children who bring her a lot of joy, which is what we would expect for a mother. Now, since 2013, Anthony and all his siblings had actually been on the radar of Child Protective Services. And it is shocking. It really is, because we're always going to be looking at missed opportunities and lessons learned. That's really imperative during these cases so that the cycle is not repeated. But in total, over the years, the social workers would actually be working with the family for 3.5 years in total. And during that 3.5 years, they would actually assign 12 social workers to the case during that time. 3.5 years, 12 social workers. There's no consistency. That means that there are going to be so many opportunities for really important information to fail to be gathered, and certainly really important information to be failed to be passed on. So initially, we're looking at a fracture in the foundation within this story already. Now, at one point, Anthony had been removed from Barron and Labour's care. And the reason for this, it was alleged that his grandfather was sexually abusing him. This is when he's just 4 years of age. But they return him home because his grandfather is removed from the property. That is understandable behaviour. When it comes down to it, if you remove the risk and threat from a home, then obviously a child will be returned to the family. Now, after that, the family receive in-home counselling on a weekly basis, which you would imagine, I don't know, is going to start uncovering the kind of issues that that household might endure and experience. Putting it out there right now, because I am perplexed on every single level about how what happens during this case happens. We also have a period of time where Anthony goes and lives with aunt and uncle. That's for two periods during 2014-2015, and they'd actually offered to keep him because they were nice, caring people who clearly felt that they were going to do a better job than Barron, which they would have, but she refuses, and she tells them specifically why she's refusing their help. It's not because, oh my God, I love my child, I want him back. It's not because I miss him and I just want to make sure that he's happy at home. No, she specifically says, I need the benefits. So, like I said, this is purely motivated by financial gain. Now, behind the walls of the family's apartment, what can I say? Anthony was being subjected to the most horrific campaign of abuse, and that's at the hands of his own mother and her 6'1" boyfriend, Lava. I put that height in because you can imagine that's like a giant to a young child, isn't it? A tall man to a young child, he's like a giant. He's going to be really intimidating. Also, Lava is not a nice guy. You won't be surprised to know that at this point. So he's allegedly a member of a really violent international gang called MS-13. This gang was known for brutal gang wars, murder, sex exploitation, drug smuggling, human trafficking, and even transport of illegal immigrants. So basically all-round horrendous human beings. And also, to add to the problematic situation at home, both Baron and Lava have also been abusive individuals before they've even met each other. But together, well, what can I say? They would become deadly. Now, Anthony isn't the only child in the household who's the target of abuse. So his two younger half-siblings also suffer. But it does seem that the other children are left unharmed, and this is very common in households. If you select a certain amount of individuals, sometimes just one within a family unit, and you take all of your anger and violence out on them, and everybody else is essentially kept safe from harm, the consequences are that when investigations are done, it seems that you are actually running a decent household, and it gives less leverage to a child who has injuries or maybe speaking out about abuse, because obviously the other siblings are not validating what's going on. So there is a real manipulation level to why you select either a few victims or just one victim in a household. And without a shadow of a doubt, that's why they will have done it. Now, Lava is also violent towards Baron on occasion. So he's a domestic abuser, and he's actually convicted of domestic abuse in 2010. But when you compare the kind of abuse that went on between him and Baron compared to what happens to Anthony, we can say that the vast majority of violence was reserved for Anthony, which we all know is beyond reprehensible. We're talking about a really young child. Now, Baron and Lava enjoyed it. I don't know how else to say it. When you think about sadistic behavior and actually natural sadists, they both fit the category of being those sadists. They really seem to be enthralled with the torture and abuse. And also, I would say they liked inventing ways of abusing him. So that's why I talk about sadism in that respect. When you think about violence in the household, and it's never acceptable under any circumstances whatsoever, but at times, a parent will be violent to a child, a partner will be violent to a partner, and it's in the moment, and then it's over, and it's completely inexcusable, certainly criminal, and definitely needs dealing with. But they're not sitting there thinking, how can I create really torturous experiences for this human being? What can I do to further add injury or pain to this situation? What can I invent that's going to make this situation even more diabolical for this human being? The premeditation within those thought processes is all about sadism, and both of these individuals do that. Now, whilst Lava's basically the ringleader in all this, I would say that Baron is more than happy to just sit and watch it happen. And to be a mother, and again, I sometimes feel like on a psychological level, and actually an action-based level and familial level, I come down harder on females, and I shouldn't at all, because it is the same ward that you are given when you have a child. It's your job to bring them up in a safe and loving environment. But because I am female, and because I am a mother, and because I do believe that whilst men and women are very similar, we females tend to be more nurturing and empathic, certainly are in personality tests, then to some degree, I expect a female within the household to care deeply about a child who's being put into a situation of pain and neglect and fear, and to have a bigger reaction than even a loving male who would also have a big reaction. Not being disrespectful to men. My father was the best person in the world. He was my savior in so many ways. What I'm trying to say is, it's hard for me to imagine what kind of a human being you are as a mother if you are happy to sit and watch the abuse and torture of your child play out in front of you. Most women would do everything within their power. Most men would do everything within their power to stop that happening. So she witnesses the abuse, She also actively takes part herself. In fact, one of the things that she's particularly good at is she devises a lot of the torture techniques, and then Labour actually enforces them. So this is a duality. This is two people acting in the same manner and feeding off one another and enjoying it. They're enjoying it. How on earth are we ever meant to understand and stretch our imagination to a point where we can truly connect with these kind of monsters? I would not need a second to act where a child is in danger. I would just do it at a risk to my own life. And that's what the well-adjusted humans who are adults in our community all respond and react like, because we care deeply about the vulnerable. But these two do not care at all. Now, according to the reports that I've read and found, in mid-2018, 10-year-old Anthony comes out as gay. I'm going to tell you now, I really struggle with how this is reported. I'm going to tell you why. Apparently, he comes out as gay because he says he liked girls and boys. He's 10. He's 10. Look, I get it. At the moment, we're in this flux in our society where children are at points being given opportunities to make decisions about who they are in a way that we didn't do 30 years ago. But I've worked with children for many, many years. And at 10 years of age, it's very unusual for a child to be very sure of who they are. And when it comes down to sexuality, they're really not motivated in that context at that age. And the exploration of bodies is beginning, and the formation of the people that they find attractive may be budding. But certainly, if you say to somebody as a kid, I like girls and boys, the likelihood is because you like girls and boys. You're not thinking about them in a physically intimate way. And actually, lots of kids, when they're younger, have crushes on members of both sexes because they just idolise them, their best mates, or the cute kid in the playground, and the popular child at school. These are all things that happen. But this is what the reports say, that he came out as gay because he said he liked girls and boys. Now, if he did say that, in fact, to Baron and Labour, and let's just go with the idea that potentially what has been reported is factual, and he was trying to come out to them, I would say that for a child being tortured in the most heinous ways by these horrific human beings, that would have taken incredible courage, because these two are incredibly homophobic. And again, that's why I just do not feel that convinced. Because I think that he probably was well aware in the household of what would happen to him if he were to actually say those things. And I don't think he'd have chanced it, but I can only report what's out there. I'm just gonna also add in, as I've noted, my personal beliefs regarding that. So we don't actually factually know what the circumstances are of this alleged revelation, but what we do know is from then on, it seems to coincide with this increase in the severity of abuse. There's definitely an element of homophobia to it. So whether he had owned his sexuality, which I question deeply, or whether he just said, I like boys and girls, when he was having a conversation, as most children should be safely allowed to have, it's another leverage that these two use to essentially beat him with. Baron and Labour had apparently expressed their strong views on homosexuality many, many times. And it's terrifying to think that they're using their inaccurate, inappropriate and despicable homophobia to project this onto a little boy. His mother used incredibly derogatory words. So I don't know what slurs are in other countries, but certainly in the UK, the word faggot is used as a gay slur. And I know that in the States, it's also used as a gay slur. And to be calling your child that is something demeaning, it's something humiliating, and it's something that, if you are homosexual, is gonna cut you deeply. Because the one thing that anybody would want in a loving home is support for who they are. And Labour actually goes on to say that he just didn't feel secure with homosexuals, Why labour? Because your assumption is that somebody's going to actually like you. I don't think you need to worry. I'm pretty sure that anybody who's homosexual is going to be giving you a wide berth at all points in time. So behind closed doors, we're basically getting to a point where the abuse genuinely is consistent and constant. Anthony was always in trouble. He did nothing wrong. There were no triggers for this trouble. It was simply that they consistently wanted to aggress him. And to give you some examples, if he cried, so when he's about to be abused, if he starts crying, or he starts to cry during the actual punishments, which would be completely typical, can you imagine being beaten and harmed and abused and tortured and being expected to just take it? So when he understandably breaks, he gets punished further. They just get more and more severe. And I'll give you some examples of the kind of horrific abuse that they inflicted on this child. So, like I said, they thought these out. So some of the punishments included being made to kneel in a corner on uncooked rice for hours at a time. Now, anybody who's knelt down for a long period of time, you know the impact it has. It's very painful. But imagine going through that with rice digging into your skin. And then after he'd done that for hours and hours and hours, he'd be made to clean up the mess, and often the rice would apparently be left bloody. Sometimes when he was being punished, Labour actually pressed his foot onto his knees just so he could increase the pressure. And then if that little boy cried, Labour continued applying pressure until he stopped. And if you think about the psychological context there, you have a child in agony. You then have a child being forced to endure more agony and they're expressing emotion. And then you continue the pressure until they stop crying. You put them to a place of such helplessness that the actual normal, typical physical response of expressing pain and crying is literally subdued, kept down. Because no one's coming to help. There's no point crying. Because literally the physical expression is doing more harm than good. That's pushing somebody to such an extreme of helplessness. And when a child stops reacting in those circumstances, they genuinely are at a place of absolute loss. Their environment, they can't trust. They can't trust their emotional reactions. And instead, they just totally stop exhibiting the emotions. They switch off, essentially. Now, on one of the occasions, he is so angry that Anthony's reacted with tears, he actually dragged him across the carpet and there were severe friction burns caused. Also, Anthony's constantly slapped, beaten by his mother, beaten by Labour. And Labour had a particular thing where he'd like to use wrestling holds on him. So you can imagine this 6'1" grown-ass man doing this to this little 10-year-old boy. But he just enjoys the power and domination that he has. Like I said, he's totally sadistic. Also, he enjoyed whipping him with a belt on his body, his back, his buttocks, and also the soles of his feet. Now, fortunately, the vast majority of you will not have been abused. I know that some of you will be relating to this on a personal level, but when you literally belt the soles of the feet, for those runners out there, for those serious walkers out there, you will know what it's like when you get pain in your ankles, soles, and balls of your feet. It can feel like you've got electric shocks running all the way through your body. Imagine somebody purposefully and willfully impacting that area consistently with a belt. It makes movement agonizing, and it is. It's genuinely like you have shocks all the way up your body. And he even went as far as to whip him on the soles of his feet whilst he's kneeling on that rice. It's like he's just trying to think of even more damaging ways to harm this child whilst the child is being harmed. Labour also found a hose from the Hoover and he'd whip him with that, and they are heavy. They are really heavy. Another thing that he liked to do was to pick him up by his ankles, hold him upside down, and then drop him repeatedly on his head. This child is 10. Bear in mind, the brain is forming all the way up until 25. Constant head bumps is going to have a huge potential impact on his development and is also incredibly dangerous. Just think about the bleeds that can occur. But he doesn't care. He's doing it repeatedly. And another thing that he and Baron would do, his own mother, is they'd get cigarettes that were lit and then they'd burn him with them. How do these people get blessed with these babes when so many are denied that opportunity? It just feels excruciating, unfair. It really does. Now, Anthony is going to school. So at the time that all this is going on, he does have access to education and people around him, which I'll come on to later on, because it's not unnoticed what's going on to some degree with Anthony and his safety. But when he comes home from school, he'd often be made to just stand in the corner until 8 p.m. So no freedom, no peer interaction, no being a child, you know, just being a child. Most children walk in through the front door. And I mean, the vast majority, even children from challenging environments where there is dysfunction in the home, they'll still tend to come in from school and then have some free time, maybe play with their siblings, go outside, run riot, just be children. But not him. Basically just told, go stand there quietly. And then other times he's forced to kneel in the hallway, and they would have this particular thing where they'd get him to hold books with weights tied on top for hours. And if he dropped them literally at any point, he'd be made to start all over again. And then they even had this thing that they called captain's chair. And so when they did this captain's chair, basically they made him lean against the wall with his legs bent in this sitting position. And that's incredibly painful. I mean, any of you who do resistance exercises, you'll know that when you place yourself in a certain position, the rest of your body starts to retaliate against you. You know, the lactic acid builds up. It's incredibly painful. And if he moved or cried, he'd just have to start again. And Baron and Leva obviously are incredibly lazy people, so they didn't always manage the situation where they were watching him. So they get the other kids to keep watch. They actively engage the other children in his abuse. And on one level, we think, how could a sibling do that? And I think that's a very, very reasonable perspective to have. But most siblings just think, thank God it's not me. And another bias is, well, they don't hurt me, so therefore he must have done something wrong to deserve this. And that's often why you get the silence from the other siblings. So the siblings come, watch. If he doesn't do them correctly, he's made to then do exercises from a workout list. It's just a constant attempt to physically and psychologically break this gorgeous little boy. There's a particular occasion as well where somebody throws a brick at Leva's car, which you'd understand because he's a horrible human being in gangs and loads of people will hate him. Yes, they'll fear him, but they'll hate him. And I guess getting one over on him would be quite a positive thing for them psychologically. But he sees this as a real slur and he decides that he's going to take all of his anger out on Anthony. So he brings that brick in that Anthony's had nothing to do with, and he just makes him carry it around the apartment. And Anthony is in tears whilst he's being made to do this. And when he does that, his mum just starts screaming at him to shut up. So again, this constant projection. Whenever Leva or Baron have feelings of negativity or that they're struggling themselves, it's just an easy get out to project all of that onto this little boy. And they even got him and his two younger siblings to have fights with each other. And it was almost like some kind of sick fight club reenactment. So literally, the mother would just sit there and watch whilst this was happening. So encouraging, stroke forcing these siblings who are one another's support to some degree because they're all encountering the abuse, and actually set them up against each other. So disabling and further isolating those relationships. And it's not just the physical abuse, which is more than enough. It's the neglect. It's the absolute neglect. So Anthony is denied food. He's denied water. He gets locked in his room. And if you think about being denied food and water, they are obviously things required for survival. Water, more than anything, it's incredible how long you can survive without food. But wow, if you are dehydrating a child's brain, believe me, there is a massive vulnerability there. Physiologically, it is disastrous, but this is happening to him regularly. And when he's allowed out of his room, it's not as if he can just go and help himself to a drink of water. No, they just watch him really carefully. They want to make sure that he doesn't eat, that he doesn't drink anything. And then if they were going to actually feed him, they would inflict torture. So they give him really unpleasant things as far as he was concerned to eat, like peanut butter on a tortilla. And if he didn't eat it quickly enough, then they'd give him something that really was unpleasant. So they put things like chili sauce on it. They used to take chili sauce and hot sauce and pour it directly into his mouth. And you can imagine for a child, that's incredibly distressing. Forcing somebody to eat something they don't want is incredibly upsetting anyway. And then adding to that the pain that's inflicted, it would just be extremely horrifying to have your caregivers do this. He's denied real food because apparently he's always in trouble, and this seems like a reasonable punishment. So he's not actually able to eat as the other family members do. And he's even told that proper food is a privilege. So they're letting him know, you don't deserve this. And can you imagine psychologically being that child? You're in this state of confusion, this state of pain, this state of neglect. And in your mind, you're thinking, what do I need to do to change so these people will treat me how I need to be treated? What am I doing wrong? The shame, the sadness, the guilt that he might have felt that were all not his to feel, you can imagine that they would totally be congruent with what he's going through, because he's thinking, what must it be about me that means these people who are meant to love me are acting like they hate me? Also, Anthony's brother at some point sneaked out of his room one night to actually try and find food. And that's totally understandable. When you're being starved and you're not able to drink, you're going to be desperate and the survival mechanism kicks in. But of course, that means there are major consequences. So Baron and Lever even put an alarm on the bedroom door. And again, just to highlight, think about what that says about the psyche of these two individuals. And this is a full-time job for them to make it more and more difficult for their children to survive in a fashion that's conducive with actually living, because they're going out of their way to ensure time and time again that their lives are being put under threat. To actually go to that length to put an alarm on the bedroom door. And they're not short of a bob or two, these guys. Yeah, they might be on benefits, but he's making money from every avenue you can imagine in the darkest of ways. And she's basically claiming as much cash as she can from the state, and she'll have been on every extra loophole you can imagine, because that's the kind of mindset that she has. Food should not be a problem. So this is about wanting to strip away the rights and dignity of the children, and in particular of Anthony. They would lock him in his room for hours at a time. And of course, this means he hasn't got any access to a toilet. So sometimes he'd had to go to the toilet in his bedroom and urinate, defecate, of course he would. And Lever would literally hold him to the floor and rub his face in it. And then they'd make him sleep on that floor. What kind of adult would do this? They're responsible for the reality of this child having to use the toilet in that fashion, and then they're utilizing that as a reason to further impact negatively on that child. And the enjoyment is clear. They're just looking consistently at an opportunity to express the violent desires that lie within each of them. Now, as I said earlier on, he is going to school, and it does not go unnoticed that people have concerns about this child's well-being. And there is major concerning aspects in this case. So first of all, there are multiple reports to Los Angeles County Department of Fire and Family Services, multiple. So people aren't sitting back. We're not talking about a case, which we've talked about many times on this channel, where children are neglected by everybody. You know, neighbours, friends of the family, they don't really do anything, they see it happening. No, not in this case. No. There are multiple reports. So when Anthony is six, his aunt is that concerned about what's happening to him that when she's in therapy, she says to her therapist, look, Anthony's mother's hitting him, starving him, even keeping him in a room for hours. They're not giving him access to a bathroom. And obviously a therapist, like in the UK, in America, is a mandated reporter, And that means that you have to speak to social services when you hear about safeguarding issues around children. So that therapist does the right thing and reports the abuse by calling a child abuse hotline and essentially says this is happening. Another report comes from a daycare worker. She's seen bruises on Anthony and bruises on the younger sibling, and she feels like there is something going on there. And when she speaks to Baron, she actually says, well, no, of course, there's nothing wrong in my home. Those marks that you're talking about, they're all caused by the kids fighting each other. It's just siblings. But that worker isn't convinced. So she speaks to the kids, and they say at the time that these bruises had been occurring, that basically the mother wasn't actually at home and labour had made them fight each other. So now that care worker's thinking, my God, what is happening that this grown man is forcing children to fight? So she's reported about this. She's really concerned. Then, and this is unbelievable, we have the assistant principal, you know, a person of great standing and power, who's at Anthony's elementary school, and they call social services because Anthony had actually said that he was being forced to look for food in a bin because he was really hungry and that he's being beaten by his mother. So at this point, we have a direct connection with a child actually telling somebody in the welfare of their care that they need help. And that assistant principal is reporting this and saying, look, this child is in danger. And then if that's not enough, Anthony's own uncle has reported concerns. He'd witnessed physically labour beat Anthony. Also, he'd watched him dangle him out of a second story window by his ankles. And he'd seen scabs and bruises on his ears. We don't expect to see that. It's a big red flag if you see ears that are damaged, because it means that usually somebody's been dragging them around by them or lifting them up. They're not contextual with childhood. Usually it's an abuse reality. And he actually could see that it had been labour who'd been dragging Anthony around by his ears. And Anthony had even gone on and told his uncle that labour picked him up and slammed him against the floor, into walls, into furniture. These are all directly handed to social services. Now, on several occasions, they do go out. So social workers do call at the apartment. But during the visits, as you would imagine, Anthony's siblings have been coached and are basically told to lie about what's happening in the household. And bear in mind, lots of children will do what they're told by their parents, particularly if they're incredibly scared of their parents. Now, between the years of 2013 to 2016, there have been at least 13 reports. That's right, 13 reports to child services. One was even from another social worker. So an actual social worker working in the field who'd said, this is not right, there is something seriously amiss in this household. Despite all of that, social services concluded that the reports of physical abuse were either unfounded or inconclusive. Unbelievable. Unfounded. So lies. That's what they're saying there. Or inconclusive. Oh, we don't have too much evidence. You had all those reports from mandated reporters. They had seen injuries. You had people in their family, multiple people in the family, literally telling you that they'd witnessed abuse. And you're saying it's unfounded or inconclusive. So basically malicious or unproven. Absolute BS. Now, one of the social workers, just a bit of additional information here, who'd been assigned to the family's case, was a woman called Barbara Dixon, not the singer, with respect. But she, on reflection, was heavily criticised because she had already been involved in the 8-year-old Gabriel Fernandez case. Now, that's another infamous face. She'd failed to spot this horrific abuse that was going on where Gabriel was concerned. And Gabriel died in 2013, May 2013, and he had been really badly, severely abused and tortured by his mother and her boyfriend. So she'd been criticised for the failings there. And then subsequently, she's criticised for the failings in Anthony's case. And for that, she gets placed on 4 years probation in March 2022. Can somebody please write in to let me know how somebody who has literally been involved in the torture and abuse and death of two children, yes, I know they were not directly responsible for that, and I also appreciate in this case that there were multiple social workers failing here, but can we please honestly answer how you only get 4 years probation? Surely she should have lost her job. You're not made out for this kind of work. If you can't spot the serious abuse and torture of a child, they are the most extreme examples that we'll ever come into contact with, then what the hell are you missing elsewhere? How are you just getting 4 years probation? And like I said, it's not just her, she and multiple other social workers all failed Anthony. But man, what are we saying when we let people like that stay in the job? Because to me, it kind of makes it feel like the deaths of these children are not that serious to the services who are meant to protect them. And also, I appreciate that it is the parents' job and duty to safeguard the children, and the social workers are not the ones who are the heinous human beings that we're discussing right now. But you should not be in a job where the hallmarks of child abuse and torture just seem to go over your head. We get to the 19th of June 2018. Now, bear in mind, I have been talking about the sustained abuse that he's been enduring and the level of abuse that he's been enduring. So none of you will be surprised that his physical condition is now severely deteriorating. And actually, it got to the point where he looked so ill that even Baron had accepted that she'd probably have to take him to hospital. Now, at the point where she decides that she wants to do that, Anthony is absolutely exhausted. Can you imagine where you would be psychologically as that little boy? And when she says about taking him to hospital, he just says, could I just be allowed to sleep? So we now know that Anthony is in a dire place. He obviously looks terrible. He obviously is in a position where his abusive parent is thinking, maybe this has gone too far. And he is in that point of helplessness where he just wants to close his eyes and just stop it all. And it's that level of, please just let what's happening end, let me end. That's how I feel he would have been feeling at that moment in time. At the time that he asks her to just let him sleep, he's lay on the bedroom floor, he's unable to move. So instead of taking him to hospital at that point, she just allows him to stay there. She just leaves him. By that evening, he's literally still on that floor in the same position. And of course, he's now been neglected for a further day and his condition's deteriorated even further. And whilst he's in that state, Lava doesn't think about calling an ambulance, having a conversation with Baron about, my God, this is really serious. No, he just repeatedly picks him up under the armpits and then just drops him back onto the floor. Apparently that happened about 10 times. Just picking him up, dropping him to the floor, this unresponsive child. They leave him the whole night. And then the following morning, this is the 20th of June, 2018, Anthony's completely unresponsive. This 10-year-old little boy who's been left in that state for days. He's not waking up. Still lying on the bedroom floor where he'd last been dropped. At this point, his mother decides, oh, I better bring him round, because she is, I don't know, delusional, and thinks that somehow throwing water on his face is going to do it. But that's what she does. She throws water over him, cold water, in an attempt to bring him round. And then she finally carries him downstairs. And at this point, obviously, he's been lay on the floor. He's got cold water all over him. So now he's been freezing. And she calls 911. This is about 12:15 p.m. The amount of time that has passed at this point is catastrophic. She then tells the dispatcher a whole load of lies, because we know that these narcissists are always going to be thinking about protecting themselves. And she says that Anthony had injured himself and apparently he wasn't breathing. I mean, even that makes no sense. He's injured himself. I've not really thought about how he's injured himself yet. Can't really conceive in this moment of how I'm going to excuse it. So I'm just going to say he's injured himself and he's not breathing. That's the only context that she gives. Now, when the paramedics arrive, obviously they're going to be horrified. A child who is critically injured is always going to be psychologically distressing for them. And it's the last thing that you want to deal with on a day-to-day level, because you want to save lives, not deal with the end of lives. They can see Anthony, just by looking at him, is in a really critical condition. They describe him as literally looking dead. They genuinely walked in and saw that his eyes were sunken. He was unresponsive, and he was actually in full cardiac arrest. And they just started to desperately try to revive him. Now, the emergency responders, they're immediately suspicious. They are used to seeing children on a regular basis. And what they can see regarding his physical condition is that, first of all, he's massively malnourished. They could literally count his ribs. They described him as looking emaciated and looking like a cancer patient. And I think we can all relate to an image in our head where we've actually known somebody with cancer, or we've seen pictures online of individuals with cancer. They do at times look like they have literally lost all their body weight. It's very distressing. Obviously, when they're going through things like chemotherapy, that can additionalize it. But that's the kind of image that many of us hold of a cancer patient who's really, really unwell. And that's what resonates to those responders. They notice that he's covered in bruises, he's covered in cuts, he's covered in scrapes. His knees even have sores on them, because obviously they've kept him kneeling on that rice and it's caused these big sores. And also, the thing that really stands out is, bear in mind, if you have called emergency services and you think your child may be dying or in fact dead, I mean, they are going to be trying to pull you down off the ceiling. They are going to be trying to calm you, because you are going to be hysterical. You are going to be living your worst nightmare, and it's going to be in technical in that moment, and it's going to be horrific. But she doesn't seem upset. She doesn't cry. She's not even slightly hysterical. In fact, they said that she seemed calm. Now, bear in mind, at that moment in time, the paramedics are given CPR on her 10-year-old severely unwell son. At one point, somebody recorded that she said, "Come on, Anthony. Come on, Anthony." Sorry, he's not in a race, love. You know, you're not stood on the sidelines at sports day at school whipping him on because he's in the, I don't know, three-legged race. We're talking about your child having CPR because he's in cardiac arrest. And even the person who heard that said, look, it really didn't sound genuine. They were really unconvinced by her. And they were certainly unconvinced by the claim that her little boy had been really well and had been playing out the day before, because he's got all these bruises and sores on his body. She says, oh yeah, the reason that he got injured is that he hit his head whilst playing basketball. I mean, like I said, she is certainly not a sophisticated predator. She's absolutely challenged in the mental department, intelligence-wise, without a doubt. Because if it were that he'd hit his head during playing basketball the day before, and this had caused this reaction, well, they would need a lot more emergency responders, because kids are forever hurting their heads doing things like that. They would be dropping like flies. But then she thinks, obviously, that's not enough. She has to rethink that strategy. So later down the line, she says, oh, actually, you know what else? He had this big tantrum and he actually threw his head back against the floor. Again, now we're projecting that he's purposefully and willfully injured himself, and that she is just the victim of circumstance in this situation that has done all that she can by calling the emergency responders when it's obvious that he's become unwell. But they can see he's been very sick for a very long time. And also, when they look at the injuries all over his body, they're all at different stages of healing. So it's a sustained period of abuse. This hasn't happened in one incident. At this point, they decide that they need to get Anthony to hospital as quickly as possible. They place him on life support. He can't breathe on his own at this point. And essentially, it's very quickly transpired that there's nothing that the doctors could do for him. And the reason for that is they established he was already brain dead, and he physically died the next morning. Although obviously, when you're brain dead, you're not necessarily even in your body anymore. And please God, let him have been lifted to another dimension, drenched in love. We all hope that for him in that moment. Now, the coroner has to look at all the injuries that this gorgeous little boy has endured. And it's utterly harrowing. I always read the coroner's reports, and it's one of those things that I need to do to truly understand the extent that these children suffer. I need to know, because their stories are so powerfully important. Their stories motivate us to do better, and to just see the kind of brutality these children endure, it's powerfully important for me, because it means I'm staring in the face of this reality. I'm not going to hide from it. I don't want to hide from it. The coroner said that his body was literally head to toe in bruises, burns, and abrasions. Even his face, nose, and forehead had marks all over them. There were small circular burn marks on his stomach and below his nipple, so they're cigarette marks. There were abrasions on both his knees, on his back. He had lots of contusions and scabs on his arms and his legs. He found multiple bruises to his abdomen, to his hips, to his buttocks, to his back, also sunken eyes. He'd also suffered blunt force traumas to his head and to his brain, and also he'd suffered blunt force trauma to several areas of his body. Another big indicator as to why he was so ill is because he was heavily malnourished. Ribs were showing through his skin. And when they concluded how he died, they said he died from severe dehydration and a bleed on the brain. Like I said earlier on, it is so dangerous for a child to have water withheld from them. But indeed, that was part of their MO. That was part of how they affected the torture on this little boy. Now, during the police interviews, detectives apparently became really suspicious of comments made by Laver. Bear in mind, these aren't on public record. They just talk about the fact that they're very suspicious. That hasn't been reported what was exactly stated. But we're not talking about Sherlock Holmes in this interview. These are not individuals who are the brightest sparks in the book. You can imagine some of the things that Laver is going to be saying. You can imagine that he's going to be quite self-incriminating when he isn't thinking that he's being self-incriminating. But above everything else, these detectives, they are well-schooled. They will know that it's Laver and Barron who are responsible. The likelihood is they just need to figure out who is more responsible. Are they jointly responsible, and so on and so forth, and just give themselves enough rope to hang themselves with. Sometimes I think that might be an option that should be considered. How much rope would you like? Anyway, like I said, at the end of the day, these two were interviewed, and you won't be surprised to know that they both deny harming Anthony. In fact, they just stick to this story that he hurt himself. He threw himself to the ground. And somehow this is how he damaged himself. In fact, I mean, you'd have to add a time machine to it. When he threw himself to the ground, then he got in his time machine and he went back in time so that some of the things healed, and he came forward in time and he did it again, because they've got all these different forms of healing on his body. So none of this makes sense, but this is what they're sticking to. And it is amazing how many criminals believe that if they just tell the same story again and again and again and deny it, that that's going to be enough to prevent them being actually incriminated on a criminal level. The police, no, straight away, this is absolute rubbish. The injuries suggested a sustained period of abuse, and they actually go as far as saying that they believe that Barron had waited until Anthony was actually dead before they even called emergency services. And the reason for that is they didn't want Barron talking. They didn't want him to speak out. So it's all about avoiding suspicion, even if avoiding suspicion is at a cost to that little boy's life. Now, what they could tell, because obviously injuries heal over time, but they could absolutely validate that Anthony had literally been seriously abused for at least 2 weeks before his death. Now, we all know the abuse had been for a huge amount of time before that, but they can validate that 2 weeks. Of course, his mother just says she's totally innocent, absolutely nothing to do with her. In fact, she said this, and again, you know when a person needs to overreach a statement to try to validate their innocence? It's almost too extreme. It's when people say things like, I would never do that. I promise that I would never do that to anyone. I swear on my child's life. You don't need to. You didn't do it. Stop asking somebody to believe you because you're willing to throw your child in front of the bus when it comes down to making deals with the big GOD. You know, it's those kind of reactions that put you on the back foot and you think you don't need to do that. So she says, I promise I did not hurt my son. I did not let nobody hurt my son. I swear he was just acting up and he threw himself because he didn't want to eat. Like, I swear, you know, it's just that I promise, again, totally unnecessary, pleading with them to believe. You don't need anybody to plead with anybody when you're telling the truth. You're just telling the truth. She also sees fit for some bizarre reason to tell the police that she thought that Anthony might have been gay and said that when he'd told her that information, she'd said that she would love him no matter what because he was her baby. I mean, could this woman be any more dislikable and grotesque if she literally went on a course titled How to Be More Grotesque and Disliked? I don't know. Is it possible? Answers on a postcard. Now, Laver, he ends up admitting that he had actually been abusive towards Anthony. But he didn't actually tell them just how abusive that he'd been. So he said, yeah, you know what? I was abusive to some degree. So for example, I did make him kneel on the uncooked rice. Sorry, you did what? I made him kneel on uncooked rice. I'm just going to return you to your cell. And just out of interest, have you ever experienced kneeling on uncooked rice? No. Well, it's really surprising because for your dinner tonight, we are going to make Chef get you a big pile of uncooked rice. And then we're going to make you kneel on said uncooked rice for, I don't know, maybe a month. Genuinely, you can't even imagine admitting that, can you? Because it's so grotesque and it's so extreme. And it also shows that this guy, when he's saying it, doesn't necessarily think that that's the worst admission. And if he doesn't think that's the worst admission, my God, what was he doing to that little boy? Also, he does go and admit that he knocked him unconscious for about 5 minutes a few days earlier. And again, a lot of you will know about head injuries and will be aware that there is a very serious potential when somebody is knocked unconscious, particularly for 5 minutes, that needs checking out immediately. In fact, my son is a Thai boxer. He had a car crash, the airbag hit him. It meant an absolute strikeout of sparring, let alone fighting, but sparring just in his local group for 30 days because it can be catastrophic for the brain. And that's after going in and get checked out by the local hospital just in case. When you are out for 5 minutes, that is serious impact and that can cause serious injury. For any parent out there, if you imagine your child literally being unresponsive for 5 minutes, I mean, after 7 seconds would be on the phone to emergency services, they'd be here 2 minutes after the kid woke up because that's what you would be doing. You would be getting them to come and help. They just leave him. That's horrific. Now, both Laver and Baron are ultimately charged with Anthony's first degree murder. That's in June 2018. Of course they are. You may as well have just had a dot-to-dot drawing demonstrating their guilt because it's so obvious. And they actually have this special charge as well. And it's including the special circumstances allegation of murder. So this involves the infliction of torture. Now, of course, in spite of the wealth of evidence, in spite of all the reports that went into social services, in spite of the injuries that are clearly from them, in spite of one of them at least admitting that he'd knocked this kid out and made him kneel on rice for hours, both of them plead not guilty. Now, Baron, of course, she thinks, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put all the blame on Laver. And she goes so far because she is a heinous human being. She is a predator of the highest order. She is a monster disguised as a mother. She thinks, I can get out of this. So I'm going to use the battered woman syndrome defense. Now, I am the first person to note that battered woman syndrome absolutely exists. We have seen women murder their partners because they didn't think that they could get away any other way. And some of them have faced really severe consequences. Some of them have been allowed this defense effectively and been released from prison or been tried and been found not guilty because of it. But how dare this woman use it? She is the batterer, and yet she thinks that she can use this and it'll basically mean that she gets off with her child's killing. But this defense, in her concept of it and the way that it's brought into the court, is that basically, yes, the abuse happened, but I didn't have any power to stop it. I didn't have any power to say no. Really? What, when you were going out of your way to design torturous experiences for your child, you didn't have any way of getting out of it? When you sat back and watched your child being tortured, when you encouraged the children in the house to literally watch the child whilst they were being tortured and return information that would then mean you could torture the child more, all of that is going on, and yet she thinks that she can use this to walk away. Now, in spite of the fact that we know that's BS, one of the things that you could say about her history is that she'd actually been subjected to similar abuse when she was a child from her stepfather. But as opposed to breaking that cycle, as opposed to recognizing the own pain that she endured in her childhood and realizing that she can do better, be better, no, she chooses, and it is a choice, to perpetuate the cycle of abuse against her own children. And even worse, she uses labor as her enforcer, as her bouncer, so to speak. She does it willingly, she does it because she enjoys it, and she does it because it's a way of her dealing with her own emotions in a really negative way, but that's what she's doing. She's projecting whatever it is onto her child. Now, initially, because of the seriousness of the injuries on this child and the seriousness of the nature of this particular criminal action, what the prosecutors want to do is get the death penalty for Barron and Labour. But this basically gets dropped in May 2021. And the reason for this is they appoint this new district attorney, and this district attorney just vehemently opposes capital punishment. And so basically they're not able to pursue the death penalty. A lot of you in America will have a difference of opinion with that particular mindset. A lot of you will feel that this particular individual shouldn't be allowed to come in and change the reality of the sentencing that could have been available had they not made that decision. A lot of you will think, well, it's a good thing that people aren't put to death. And some of you will be on the fence and think, well, at least if it's a long sentence, they'll have to suffer for a long period of time incarcerated. All of those are valid feelings and thoughts, but this is where we are. They're not going ahead with the death penalty for these two. So the trial begins January 2023. It's really recent. And Barron and Labour actually opt to have the case heard by a judge rather than a jury. And that doesn't surprise me for one minute, because let me tell you, there is nothing more emotive than child death. And these two are banged to rights. It's obvious without a shadow of a doubt that they're guilty. So they probably know that they have no chance of getting found innocent by a jury ever. Not in this dimension or any dimension, ad infinitum, in perpetuity, forever. It's as simple as that. They're going to go to prison. And I guess that they just are taking their chances with somebody who's in the know, which is obviously a judge, and that maybe that judge is going to understand the law in a different way to a jury. Now, the prosecution, they say, look, Anthony had been systematically abused. He had been starved. He had been tortured for at least 2 weeks before he died. And the defense, well, they're stuffed, aren't they? You can imagine them like looking at it, can't you? And going like, okay, we have a case where a child has clearly been brutalized and murdered, where parents and caregivers did not bother calling emergency services in time. We can't say that there was no abuse. Because if we say that there's no abuse, it means that we're terrible defenders and also we're not dealing with reality. So they decide that they have to be like, well, yeah, you know, this is a case of abuse, but not actually murder. So basically, they're like, there's just a lack of intent to kill. Yeah, they wanted to constantly brutalize and torture this child as long as they could get away with it. But did they want to kill him? I don't think so, because they like the torture, so therefore our defense is that they would have rather keep him alive to do more abuse to him. That's basically what the defense is. And the reality is, when we've talked about the injuries that he suffered, there was a consistent risk of death. And they would have been aware of that. And they were actively inciting that possibility by keeping him dehydrated. So it's absolute BS. So we get to the 7th of March, 2023. And the judge, who did not need a jury, the judge's like, you sure you don't want a jury? Just so that we can all, I don't know, give ourselves a round of applause when we all agree that you are definitely guilty. But, you know, the judge doesn't need it, essentially. They're quite happy to make the decision themselves. And they find Baron and Laver guilty of torturing and murdering Anthony. And they're also convicted of two counts of child abuse against his half siblings, because I guess that we've forgotten a little bit about them in this story because we're concentrating on the death and murder of Anthony. But remember, there were actually two half siblings who were being horribly abused as well. So it's good that they were given sentences for that child abuse, because we need to represent the suffering of those children. So we get to the 25th of April 2023. We've got 33-year-old Baron and 37-year-old Laver, both sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole, sweetheart. Neither are you going to take a breath outside of freedom ever again, and nor do you deserve to. And let's just hope your incarceration is, I don't know, infinite in this world and the next. We get to October 2022, and this is where I have absolute sympathy and empathy with Anthony's family, because they bring a lawsuit against the LA County, and damn straight they do. Bear in mind, there were at least two members of that family who reported the fact that they were concerned about the safety of the child. I mean, seriously concerned. And one was saying, I have witnessed this horrible abuse, and nothing was done. So they go ahead. They filed this particular lawsuit against LA County, and it's settled for $32 million. A lot of people don't really understand why money would be that symbolic. It's because the only way that you can hurt the system is by making the system physically pay. And money is all the system cares about on the whole. And I mean that. That's what governments are about. They're about cash. You can only hurt them when you take that cash. And for the family, it's never going to bring that little boy back. It's never going to stop the nightmares that plague them, because they didn't get to save him. But at least it is something that says Anthony mattered. His life mattered. And they found that multiple social workers had just failed. They hadn't responded effectively at all to the reports of abuse. Now, when they did a subsequent audit of Los Angeles County's Department of Children and Family Services, wow. There were so many shortcomings. And the thing about those shortcomings is, every single shortcoming places a vulnerable child at more risk. So they didn't just look in and find, shall we say, stumbling blocks, reports that weren't necessarily written as well as they should have. We are talking about literal reports of abuse that had not been investigated or hadn't been properly investigated. So each of those relates to a child's safety. And the impact of failure to investigate means that that child may come to serious harm. And the whole protection services is about protecting children from harm, abuse, and neglect. When the department is failing to even acknowledge abuse, all of those steps become very clearly more problematic. But this is what's been going on. And they found that investigations have been delayed, which had left children in really dangerous environments for months, months longer than necessary. They'd done risk assessments, but they'd been incorrectly conducted. Some of those risk assessments, guys, had been carried out without even visiting a child's home. Also, they didn't do criminal background checks when they found that people were living in the household. There were other adults living in the household. So essentially, there could be known perpetrators, sexual deviants living in vulnerable children's homes, and they didn't do checks. Now, when you think about Anthony's case, every single red flag was there and had been there for years. So, first of all, he's abused by those that are meant to care for him. He's failed by those who are meant to protect him. So in spite of this catalogue of big red flags and alarm bells, instead of that child being removed permanently from the care of those predators and those siblings of his being made safe as well, this abuse was allowed to carry on. There is a collusion. And I know that people will say, well, social services weren't actively colluding with them to cause the death of this child. But if a service is set up to protect a child and they literally are given all the information that can ensure that child is indeed protected, and then they ignore, avoid, or reject and abandon the information that is clearly absolutely realistic, because you've got mandated reporters and family members evidencing that they have seen it or are concerned about injuries, and you have a child who's elected to actually say, yes, these things are happening to me, and physically the child is injured. If you as a service don't act on that, you are colluding, because you are incentivizing the behavior of the perpetrators and giving them confidence to carry out these kind of injuries and torturous activities on that child. It is a mutual, dualistic reality that leads to a horrific, unnecessary event. And we are talking about Anthony Avalos's life and loss of life because of that. Because those who were meant to love and care for him failed, and those who were in charge of ensuring that when those failures occur, a child is protected, also abandoned that care. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.